From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. For the first time ever, the Dow Jones Industrial Average surpassed 30,000 today as Wall Street marked the formal beginning of Joe Biden's transition to power. And President Trump went to the White House briefing room today to congratulate his administration for the stock market gains in a one-minute-long press conference where he took no questions.
Regardless, the wheels of the presidential transition are now in motion, and today Joe Biden is naming a few history-making members of his cabinet. Domenico Montanaro is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Hey, Domenico.
Hey there.
And first of all, what was that moment from President Trump?
You know, he came out for 64 seconds. He touted the stock market. He said that, you know, it had gone over 30,000 and was really touting the work that his administration, he felt, had done and touting all these records that he said had been set. But, you know, it was something of the bizarre because he didn't take questions from reporters. This is the first day of the official transition. Now that he said do what needs to be done to the General Services Administrator to start the transition, and yet doesn't take questions, is touting the Wall Street and the stock market, which a lot of people obviously, you know, not looking at as the actual economy and just the stock market.
And we felt it was important to note because we haven't actually heard from President Trump in person in quite a while either. But again, the big news of the day, Joe Biden's team is starting to emerge. Let's talk about Janet Yellen for a moment. If she's confirmed, she's going to be the first woman to head the Treasury Department. Of course, she was also the first woman to lead the Federal Reserve. What does her nomination signal to you?
Well, right. You know, you noted she's the first woman to serve as the Federal Reserve Chair. She was fired by President Trump. And Biden's bringing her back into the fold. And that's what we're seeing with a lot of these positions, names that have been floated or people that have been picked, intended to put in place qualified professionals, in some cases historic, and to be something of a rebuke of the way Trump did things.
This will be a very different job for Janet Yellen because it's going to be a much more political role. How do you think she's going to approach that?
Yeah, it's interesting because most of her career has been either as a professor or serving on Federal Reserve Board as a governor. But she did serve as chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors under Bill Clinton from 1997 to 1999. So, you know, she has a little bit of White House experience in that way. You know, what I think we're starting to see is something of an Obama third term, really. You know, Janet Yellen was picked by President Obama to be put in place, at the Federal Reserve. And now we're seeing a lot of the same kinds of names, types of people, deputies moving into principal roles. There's a lot of continuity there. But of course, these are also people who've been traditionally close to Joe Biden. And of course, Joe Biden was close to President Obama.
Do you think in any way that that could be a liability for Joe Biden? I mean, there's got to be people out there who are eager to see fresh names, fresh ideas, fresh blood.
Well, you know, I think that the Biden campaign, the Biden transition team now, has been acutely aware of making sure that they have a diverse cabinet. And you've seen them roll out lots of names at once to blunt any kind of criticism that they're picking too many white men. And they want to make sure that they're showing that in the full rank of positions in the White House and in the agencies that it will look like America, which is what Joe Biden has promised that he would do. And I think that he's acutely aware that, you know, just going back to doing things the way Obama did them or how that administration functioned might not be enough for progressives in the base who have sort of changed over the last 10 years or so. And, looking for a fight after President Trump and wanting to get some big things done.
And to that point, we just have a few seconds here. Alejandro Mayorkas would be the first Latino to lead the Department of Homeland Security. Domenico, that's a big change. This is the person who created the DACA program under Obama.
I mean, this is a huge change, and I think particularly if you're somebody who is concerned about children being separated from their parents and the way that DHS and this under this president cracked down on people coming to the country. I think that this is a wholesale change and a clear rebuke of this president's, way of doing things.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Patients hospitalized with COVID-19 can require long and intensive care. And with this most recent surge in new cases, we're seeing a problem that we saw early on in the pandemic, a strain on hospitals and medical providers. In Utah, for example, intensive care units are at 87% capacity, according to the state. That's well above what's recommended from the Utah Department of Health. Joining us now is Janine Roberts. She's a nurse educator in Murray, Utah, with a respiratory ICU at Intermountain Medical Center. And Janine, thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Describe for us what you're seeing in the ICU there.
Yeah, so we have five specialty ICUs, so I can't speak for all of them, but I think they're seeing things similarly as the respiratory ICU, which is patients who are extremely ill and patients who need a long time to recover. And that means when we have really full hospitals that it causes even more strain for our caregivers. Mm-hmm.
Give us a sense of the logistics of managing the respiratory ICU. There needs to be enough nurses and physicians and protective gear.
Yeah, absolutely. Our facility to serve our community is getting more creative to provide beds. A bed is not just a bed. A bed also means staffing with all the people that you mentioned and also providing PPE. So even collaborating with supply chain has been really important in our facility. So our physicians have had to, you know, pick up more time to work and care for these patients, oversee them. Our nurses have had to pick up extra shifts. And even our techs, our critical care techs, have had to do the same.
I want to ask you about some basic things. How many beds you have in the respiratory ICU, and how many COVID patients are you treating right now?
We have 16 beds in the respiratory ICU. 12 of those beds have been cohorted, which what I mean by that, and this is being done in many hospitals across the country, is adding negative pressure to the entire unit. So we put walls up and put giant fans, cut out a hole in the window, and have all of that air sucking from the patient rooms out and away from where it could get other patients sick.
We also learned early on in this pandemic that patients with COVID-19 can also require longer hospital stays. Remind us some of the reasons why.
Yeah, so, you know, we're learning about COVID more and more. So in the beginning, you know, we didn't know exactly what worked for these patients, and that, you know, made potentially their patient stay longer. You know, we've been able to hone in on interventions that we know helps these patients, but we're still learning. And also, patients with COVID typically experience something called acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS, as we call it. And for some reason, these ARDS patients, secondary to COVID, are experiencing so many more complications and therefore require more time in the hospital, more recovery, and more extensive attention from our staff.
What are you hearing from COVID patients?
Yeah, that's an emotional question, but I recall one patient who had recently come into our unit. I was caring for him that day, and he had a picture framed of him and his family in California, which is actually where he was from, but had been vacationing here in Utah. And we had discussions about the potential for intubation or putting in a breathing tube and having him on a ventilator. And, you know, he had tears in his eyes and he was worried, but he trusted us. And he just multiple times mentioned how he wanted to come home to his family. So while he was very fortunate and we were able to get him out of the hospital and recovered, not every patient comes home.
How are you and your colleagues doing? It's a lot of strain on you. It's what you do. It's why you got into this field, is to save lives. But it's also, I can imagine, very taxing, emotionally and physically.
Yeah, it absolutely has been. I was talking to a colleague yesterday about nightmares, and you know, I've always had, you know, a casual nightmare here and there about work, but it's different with COVID. And I think it's because of this added stress of coming home and not being able to see loved ones and friends. And my coworkers are also experiencing this as well. They say, yeah, I had a nightmare about this patient the other night. It was really hard. Or, you know, I came home and I cried to my wife and she didn't know how to comfort me about this patient who passed away.
Yeah. But you're asking folks in the community to help by doing all of the things that we've been asked to do, that the CDC has recommended we do. That's the way that we can help you.
Absolutely. I understand the gravity of asking someone to stay home these holidays, but I ask that you don't hold these big group gatherings in hopes that someone that you may not even know is at high risk will be protected and be safe. For me, when you wear a mask, when you socially distance, you're being a good neighbor. I think it's so important. And if people see it as being a good neighbor and not just withholding their right to do, you know, whatever they want, then it'll be a lot easier and it'll help us out so much.
That's Janine Roberts, a nurse educator in Murray, Utah, with the respiratory ICU at Intermountain Medical Center. Janine, thank you so much for your work and thank you for talking with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Geeks, nerds, and gamers are rejoicing today. A new book, Ready Player 2, is out. It's the sequel to Ernest Cline's 2011 best-selling futuristic sci-fi novel, Ready Player One. The first book takes place in a bleak future. The Earth is ravaged by climate change. People spend most of their time inside the Oasis. It's a virtual reality world created by eccentric game designer James Halliday. Steven Spielberg adapted Ready Player One into a film in 2018.
These days, reality is a bummer. Everyone's looking for a way to escape. And that's why Halliday, that's why he was such a hero to us. He showed us that we could go somewhere without going anywhere at all.
And now Ready Player 2 gets its turn in the spotlight. Ernest Cline joins me now on Skype to talk about it. Ernest, welcome.
Oh, thanks for making time with me. It's good to speak with you too.
Sure. And so these books, it's amazing. You've created a world that is ravaged by climate change, crushed by economic catastrophe. There's even a mention of a rogue virus in there. How prophetic are you feeling right about now?
Well, you know, I don't want to be too prophetic since I envision a dystopian future and I have two little girls. I don't want them to grow up in a future like that. So I'm hoping that I'm not as prophetic as it currently seems.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's no doubt that people have wanted to escape 2020 and they definitely want to escape 2045 when your books are set. For people who aren't familiar with the virtual world that you've created in Ready Player One and now with Ready Player Two, tell us about the Oasis.
Well, the Oasis is a virtual reality that's replaced the internet. And people go to school there, people work there, people just meet up to hang out there. The creator of the virtual world, James Halliday, dies in the opening pages of Ready Player One and kind of leaves behind a posthumous message announcing a contest where he's going to give away his fortune and control of the virtual world to whoever can find these Easter eggs that are hidden throughout the virtual world.
And that brings us to the protagonist of both books, Wade Watts. A young man who, just like everybody else on Earth, is totally addicted and hooked into this virtual world. What do people need to know about Wade as part two of the story gets underway?
Well, geez, that would entail giving spoilers for Ready Player One. But we're going to assume 9 years after publication, if you're listening to this, spoiler warning. But Wade and several of his friends win James Halliday's contest in the first book and inherit control of the Oasis. In Ready Player 2, I kind of show them struggling with the ethics and the ramifications of their technology and how it affects people's lives, kind of like the heads of the social media platforms that we have in present day are doing at the moment.
Well, right. There's a feeling in book two, and again, we're not going to give away any of the major plot points here, but there is a feeling that the technology, which has advanced since Ready Player One, in the Oasis, it's advanced. There's a sense that it's getting dangerous. Is that a risk in the real world as we get deeper and deeper into artificial intelligence and virtual reality? I mean, are you trying to say that we should be careful?
Yeah, well, we have to be careful with all of our technology. And I'm not, you know, I don't think any, you know, most technology is not black or white. I think any technology that's that powerful and used by that many people, billions of people around the world, there's always going to be a good side to it and a bad side to it. So I try to show the characters wrestling with that. And the technology in Ready Player One is mostly virtual reality. And the problem that I had is in the 9 years since Ready Player One was published, virtual reality is no longer science fiction, partly yeah. because of my novel. partly it became like a self-fulfilling prophecy. And a lot of the people at Oculus and HTC Vive and the other companies that are working on virtual reality technology in the present day took inspiration from Ready Player One.
Is that right? So you'll take some credit for that.
I wouldn't if they hadn't told me and given me that credit. You know, I got invited to Oculus in the early days before they got out by Facebook, and they had a meeting room that was named the Oasis after my book, and they also told me they gave a copy of my novel to every single employee when they were hired, and they told me that there were certain things that I imagined in the book, like things describing the virtual reality interface, that they just lifted wholesale, like Oculus Home, like having an offline virtual space that you, when you first log in, that you're inside. That was something that I depicted in Ready Player One, and then they made it a reality. So I was really lucky to imagine a lot of this stuff right before the technology existed for people to really make it in the real world.
And now we're watching virtual reality evolve. And since you seem to be some kind of a prognosticator on this issue, what do you see in the future? I mean, do you think we'll be at a point, you know, where we have total immersive virtual reality, which is something that you kind of flirt with in Ready Player Two? It starts to get really real.
Yeah, I think it's inevitable. It's the brain-computer interface is what I touch on in Ready Player 2, which is where we're headed. It's the final step in the evolution of video games and virtual reality when the simulation becomes indistinguishable from real life. Right now, Elon Musk and a bunch of other venture capitalists and people in Silicon Valley are already working on a brain-computer interface and doing human trials with people who are willing to have their skull cut open and have electronics and electrodes put into their gray matter.
Okay, danger, red light flashing there. What are your thoughts about that?
Yes, but also a really good thing. Like right now, because of the medical applications, I think is what has driven a lot of this. Like there are already blind people who can see as a result of having a camera mounted on a pair of glasses with electrodes wired into their brain. Like blind people, in a very limited way, there are already blind people who can see. And then there's the cochlear implant, which is really kind of a bionic ear that allows the hearing impaired people to hear. So, and these are all brain implants to a degree.
I hear you. And I've, you know, having reported on virtual reality before, I mean, that's what all the proponents of it say. You know, like there's so many medical applications, there's so many real world applications, but should we be giving ourselves up in the way that you just described?
Yeah. And like we already kind of have that dilemma right now, right? With Twitter and Facebook, like how much of your life do you give it? And I have so many friends that are addicted to social media and they try to stop and they can't, but it's just so compelling. It like hits that dopamine rush in your brain by design. And it's designed to be engaging like that. So as our entertainment and our technology just gets better and better, the impulse to escape completely from reality would become greater and greater, I think. And then once you have a video game or a virtual reality simulation that feels just as good or better than reality, and it's a reality that you have control over, unlike the real world, then I feel like you would see people, you know, just a huge chunk of the population would want to escape into that reality and never come out.
Well, let me ask you, do you like it? Do you like virtual reality? Because the only time I ever tried it, I got sick to my stomach. I was sweating bullets. I mean, I physically hated it.
Yeah, well, you probably, that was might have been an early version of it. That happened to me the first few times that I tried it, and they've made huge improvements since then. There were problems with motion sickness and latency and stuff in the earlier versions, but I have the answer is yes. I use virtual reality all the time, especially this past year in quarantine. I ended up buying an Oculus Quest headset for pretty much everyone in my family and all of my friends just so I could get together and hang out with them in virtual reality since I wasn't able to see them in person. So every week now I get together with friends all over the country and hang out in a shared kind of virtual living room space. And we watch movies and play Risk and hang out. We had our wedding anniversary. My wife and I had our wedding anniversary in virtual reality this past summer because it was the only way.
How did she feel about that?
She was. We didn't have a choice, you know. It was exciting because we actually had all of our friends and family, a bunch of people who were at our wedding, and we were using a VR app called Big Screen that allows you to stream video and photos off your computer on a big screen while everyone sits in a virtual theater together. And so we were showing video and photos from our wedding. It was not as nice as getting to have an actual wedding anniversary party, but in the summer of 2020, it seemed pretty great. It seemed like we had mastered social distancing. You know, it's really surprising. It's different than a Zoom call. You know, everybody spent a lot of time on Zoom calls this year, but there's something qualitatively different about being in a shared virtual space. You really feel like you hung out together.
Ernest Cline, I'm sure your fans are going to want to know, is Ready Player 2 going to be made into a movie by Steven Spielberg, just like your first book was?
I would like to know that as well.
I'm sure you would.
Well, it seems like there's a chance. There's a good chance, but I, you know, we're still in the early stages of that. But, you know, he did call and check in a few times on me while I was writing it. And I did share early draft of the book with him just to get his feedback, which he was kind enough to give me.
What did he say?
He asked for more of his favorite character, a character from the first book, Nolan Sorrento. This is another spoiler. He shows up in the second book, and Stephen said, you know, I wanted more Sorrento. And I think it's because he's really good friends with Ben Mendelsohn, the actor who portrays Nolan Sorrento in our film. So I told him I would definitely put more Sorrento in the book and that I would also let Ben Mendelsohn know that Stephen was looking out for him.
And just real quick before I let you go, science fiction and fantasy writers often use this platform that they have to address other things going on in the world. We've kind of touched on this a little bit, but what do you think you're trying to accomplish with these two books? I mean, do you foresee a future as bleak as the one that you've laid out here?
I do, if we continue on the current path that we're on, where we, you know, stick our heads in the sand and pretend that climate change isn't real. My primary goal is to tell a good story and to entertain people. And I want people to have, an enjoyable, fun action adventure ride. But I can't help but weave some of my own worldview into the story. The technology in Ready Player 2 that I described, this brain-computer interface, I wanted to touch on the idea of an empathy machine. I think empathy is something we're in dire need of, people to be able to put themselves in each other's shoes. And that's one application of this brain computer interface technology, I think, is being able to put yourself in someone else's shoes. And some people who aren't capable of doing that on their own, I think it could be hugely beneficial if there was a technology that could teach people to be empathetic. It would make the world a much better place. I think a lot of the problems that we're facing right now could be traced back to a lack of empathy.
Ernest Cline, the new book is Ready Player 2. It's out today. It's the sequel to his best-selling Ready Player 1. Ernest, thank you. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
It was a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. For more than a century, a resilient city and region have relied on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve our most serious problems. The Foundation's work has been strengthened by hundreds of people who've left legacies to support our community. Leaving a charitable legacy at the Boston Foundation is a great way to have an impact now and in the future. Learn more at tbf.org/partner.
In the county of El Paso, Texas, COVID-19 has killed nearly 1,000 people. Jorge Ortiz has seen many of those deaths up close. He manages 6 funeral homes in El Paso. And as he tells us in this audio postcard, these days his job includes figuring out where to store more bodies than his funeral homes can hold, or how to have drive-through funerals and live-stream memorial services, whatever he can manage, so people are able to say goodbye to their loved ones in these difficult times.
The last 2 weeks, we have received more COVID cases than the past, I would say, months. When we hit the peak back in maybe the summer, that's nothing compared to what we're living right now. See, we have, you know, directors who are meeting with 5-6 families a day. And this is every single day. It's nonstop. We actually built a cooler inside a chapel that could hold maybe up to 100 cases. It was something that needed to be done because we were looking at the numbers just increasing. I mean, right now, sometimes we hit that capacity, you know, quick. It's very hard just to know how to manage the workload beyond the scenes and then still be there for the family. And then you have these emotions because you feel it. You're there with the family in the entire process. Many families had lost their loved ones and they haven't been there when they had passed. And they just took them to emergency. They left them there, and next time they saw them was 2 weeks later when they passed away. They saw them in a coffin. They saw them in a funeral home. there's many stories where family members have not only lost one family member, but they lost both of their parents and then brothers and, you know, sisters, other siblings, and it's a sad story. I think the hardest that I have encountered is the passing of our director. We lost one of our team members due to COVID complications. One of our funeral directors unfortunately passed away. Mr. Harrison Johnson, he definitely was a stupendous person. He was just great. When you know someone so close, I think that's when it really hits you. And I think through all this pandemic, through all this months of this pandemic, this has been the hardest in my personal life. I think I just wanna say this is reality. This is very serious, and everyone should be caring for themselves, for their health, and not only for them, but for others.
That's Jorge Ortiz, General Manager of Purchase Funeral Homes in El Paso, Texas. His story was produced by KERA's Mallory Falk. In Ethiopia, the clock is ticking toward a potentially explosive conflict in the northern region of Tigray. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed issued a 72-hour ultimatum on Sunday to the leaders of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or the TPLF. If TPLF troops don't surrender, the government says tanks will move in. Earlier today, the BBC's Kalkadan Yebitol described it this way.
There is no end in sight for this fighting, and there are fears of more civilian casualties, particularly if the fighting continues in the city of Mekelle, the state capital that is home to more than 500,000 people.
Alex Duvall is executive director of the World Peace Foundation at the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. He joins us now. And Alex, you know this part of the world very well. What are your thoughts? Is Ethiopia on the verge of a full-blown civil war?
It's already deep in a full-blown civil war. There are major tank battles. There are infantry divisions pitted against each other. There are strikes by fighter bombers and by drones. There are rockets being fired. There are massacres of hundreds of people being perpetrated. It is a full-scale civil war.
Help us understand the context, because the TPLF was an important coalition in Ethiopia's government for years before the Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, rose to power and then started making some reforms. What's driving the conflict between these two sides, and what's the TPLF fighting for?
The TPLF was head of a ruling coalition for some 28 years. And during that time, it achieved a number of things. It achieved astonishing economic growth. It achieved internal peace and stability. It also put in place a very controversial federal system of government whereby the different ethnic groups that constitute Ethiopia were given not only self-government within their own states, within the federation, but also the right of self-determination. They could even secede. But the biggest failing of the TPLF government was that it did not democratize. And a few years ago, there was a very widespread popular unrest, especially among the Oromo peoples of southern Ethiopia, against the lack of democracy, and more general discontent about the unfree press, the lack of free political parties, and so on. And this catapulted a little-known Oromo young politician, very energetic, called Abiy Ahmed, to become prime minister. And he immediately set about a reform agenda. In fact, the reforms were already underway under his hapless predecessor, who was kicked out of office. But he brought them to fruition. But what he did was he did two, three things that were perhaps mistakes. One of them is that he so enjoyed, I think, the echo chamber of being a radical reformer that he dismantled some of the key institutions that really managed Ethiopia's rather fractious politics and kept a lot of its hard-bitten politicians in check. In doing that, he alienated the TPLF. Now, definitely they needed to be reduced in power and influence, but he did make a point of consistently singling them out as the sole reason for Ethiopia's predicament and somewhat denigrating them.
So Prime Minister Ahmed has gone from making these changes. He also won a Nobel Peace Prize just last year. And now he's threatening an all-out military assault against people in his own country. Do you feel that he is inappropriately flexing his might, or is he within his rights here to try to keep the country together?
Well, one of the interesting things about the Nobel Prize is he won it for making peace with the neighboring country of Eritrea. They'd been in a Cold War for about 20 years after a very fierce border war. Now, normally when the Nobel Committee awards a prize to two countries that have made peace, both leaders share the prize. In this case, they didn't give it to the Eritrean president, Isaias Afwerki. And the reason they didn't was a very good one, which is that he is not a reformer. He runs his country a bit like a prison. There's no constitution, no media, no political parties, no freedoms at all. And for President Isaias, it was not so much peace, it was a security pact against a common enemy. And the common enemy he saw was the Tigrayans, the TPLF. And for him, I mean, his words apparently were game over TPLF. And his intent all along was to crush the TPLF. And a lot of Ethiopians were a little concerned that their reform-minded, progressive prime minister was making common cause with the most retrogressive dictator on the African continent. And what we see with this war is that there are Eritrean fingerprints all over it. And Abiy seems to be following Isaias into really what is more an Eritrean agenda of destroying the TPLF than a true Ethiopian agenda of rebalancing the country's plurality of ethnic groups and constituencies.
So what would a protracted conflict mean for the entire Horn of Africa and the continent itself?
Well, Ethiopia has, over the last 20 years or so, really been the pivot, the central pillar of a peace and security order, not only in the immediate region, but also upholding a set of norms and principles and institutions for peace and security across the African continent. And if Ethiopia were to disintegrate, as it might do, if it were to become a flouter of international norms, then a massive investment by Africa, by Europe, by the United States, the Obama administration in particular, in supporting a stable Africa would unravel before our eyes.
Meanwhile, we're seeing the Trump administration in its final days trying to remove itself, extract itself from locations around the globe, including Africa. What role does the Trump administration or the incoming Biden administration have here to play to mediate this conflict, if any?
Well, what we've seen from the outgoing Trump administration is an extraordinary position, really, which is that they say that it's a justifiable action by Abiy Ahmed against a retrograde a criminal group in Tigray. And they support both Ethiopia and Eritrea. And this is remarkable because they don't want to recognize that it's a war. Now, it may well be the case that the TPLF have committed crimes or even have provoked the war. But once a country is in war, then the same set of standards applies across the board. And threats, such as the threat that Abiy Ahmed has just made in the last few days of surrounding and bombarding the Tigrayan capital, Mekele, where the 500,000 civilians are currently living in fear, that would be a war crime. And it is completely unjustified to commit a war crime such as that, even if it would be the case that the other side started it. And the extraordinary naivety of the administration in appearing to trust Isaias Afwerki, the most unscrupulous agent of destabilization, in ruthless elimination of any enemies and rivals across the region, and that they might trust him, is a remarkable departure. The incoming Biden administration will have no such illusions, I think, and I'm sure we can trust them to demand a measure of sanity, an end to this needless conflict, to return to the negotiating table. But sadly, a great deal of damage will already have been done, and it may be too late to stop this crisis continuing or even spiraling further out of control.
Alex Duvall is director of the World Peace Foundation at the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. Alex, thanks for your insight.
You're very welcome.
Well, today New Yorkers are remembering David Dinkins, the first and only black mayor of New York City. Dinkins died last night at the age of 93. The Democrat was first elected in 1989, and he served only one term, losing re-election in a close race to Rudy Giuliani in 1993. Here's some of Dinkins' concession speech, in which he said, "Mayors come and go, but the life of a city must endure."
You see, our city's votes may be divided, but our city shall not be divided. Never forget that this city is about dignity. It's about decency. It's about the hope and determination of working people struggling to make a better life for their children and their children's children. My friends, the gorgeous mosaic is alive. It lives each and every day that the sun rises over the greatest global village on God's earth. Move forward, New York, with love, with respect, and with the knowledge that for all of us, the best is yet to come.
David Dinkins, the first black mayor of New York City, died yesterday at 93.
Google wants to be your banker. This month, the company announced a partnership with Citigroup and a California credit union to let users access their bank accounts through Google Pay app beginning next year. It's the latest move into financial services by a Silicon Valley giant following Facebook's development of a digital currency, Apple and Venmo offering credit cards, and Amazon reportedly in talks to offer its own checking accounts. For more on this, we're joined by Jason Del Rey. He's senior correspondent at Recode. And Jason, Google revamped its Google Pay app last week. Tell us more about what they're planning with this new banking service.
Right. So what we're seeing from the big tech companies is not wanting to be an actual bank, but largely wanting to sort of deepen their relationship with customers and take advantage of the fact that when it comes to customer trust, all the surveys show that a lot of these tech giants have incredible levels of trust with consumers. And so, you know, consumer finance and banking-like products are just sort of the latest way to sort of deepen customer relationships, but also, like, get an awful lot of data about us in the process.
Right. When you say deepen relationships, I'm thinking also known as getting more data from its users so they can use that data.
That's exactly right. And the common thread across a lot of these initiatives is to learn more about us. Yes, that's partially to provide us a better service, of course. And that could mean, you know, in Google's case, learning more about our consumer habits to help marketers market better to us, give us offers. That all benefits Google. But also, you know, just for these advertising platforms in general, they want to be able to target us better, yes, but also be able to track us across devices. And so part of this is to get a better feel for how we're actually spending money and how we do that on mobile phones. So a lot of this is, in fact, a data play.
And thinking about our relationships with these companies and user trust, I mean, Apple Pay is pretty popular. How do users so far feel about these kind of partnerships? Are people creeped out by these privacy implications?
I think people who, you know, have sort of long-standing privacy fears with big tech to begin with are less likely to then, you know, go forward and trust them, you know, these companies with their consumer finances or with payment information. But the truth of the matter is, like you said, you know, Apple Pay has been, you know, a slow and steady growth over the last few years. Apple is, in fact, trying to give customers an easier way to pay in stores or to pay online. But it's also about keeping people locked into the Apple iPhone ecosystem, not only trying to lure people in with that technology who might not have an iPhone, but give me, Jason Del Rey, who's had an iPhone for a long time, one less reason to flee. Yes, you have to think hard about the privacy implications, but in the case of many of us, we've already, like, that ship has sailed.
The ship has sailed, but people get funny with their money. You know, when you start to talk about direct access to banking accounts and things like that. And I know you say that these companies, these tech companies, don't necessarily want to get into the banking business, but these plays could change banking as we know it. Is there any reaction from the finance industry or traditional banks on this?
No, that's a great point, and I wouldn't want to undersell that. I think, you know, another reason these companies are going into this space is they believe, A, yes, they can leverage the trust they have with customers, but also they think whether it's just digital tools to innovate faster than the banks can, or whether it's about providing better access to financial tools online or through apps, I think they absolutely think they can innovate better than banks. What we've largely seen is some of the big banks trying to align themselves with a tech giant. Mm-hmm. I think both sides look at each other sort of as perhaps as frenemies, and they don't yet see, you know, across the board direct competition in the way of trying to become banks. But oftentimes, you know, with these types of relationships, they become more complicated over time. You know, Apple Pay started as aligning with banks and the card networks, and then you see Apple come out with their own card. Yes, it's in partnership mm-hmm. with Goldman Sachs, but, you know, someone who gets a credit card with Apple is likely not going to get a credit card with, you know, another big bank. And so it's these weird frenemy relationships. I'm still skeptical that a lot of these tech giants want to become actual banks. But the truth is they may be able to pick and choose bank-like features that attract customers without going through all the regulations that the big banks do.
That's Jason Del Rey, senior correspondent at Recode. As always, thank you so much and happy early Thanksgiving.
Same to you, Tani.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.